we spoke to you last week about mm-hmm. the hearing you went to, historic hearing, as you described it, and I mean, it's a pretty big deal. You attended the Supreme Court hearings last week, and was it just the one on Wednesday, or was it all?
I just went to the last one on Wednesday afternoon.
Okay. So you attended the Supreme Court hearing last Wednesday over the federal health care law, and you've had a few days to mull it over, process it. I know when we talked to you, it was probably still very fresh, and I think you spent about 10 minutes talking about it. It was a lot to digest.
Yeah, and I was pretty excited, so I know people wanted to ask questions, but I was wanted to get it all off my chest while I had a chance.
I understand. Well, first question, what was your reaction to the specific arguments that you heard?
Well, my time there was the Medicaid portion of the debate. And really the premise was, is the national government using coercion, forcing the states to do things in the Medicaid system? Now, Medicaid is a shared health care delivery system for the poor. And usually the states are then allowed to determine eligibility on their own. We just agree to pay 50% of that. Even in the health care national law, we have some new requirements, so we're forcing the states to expand coverage where it's really, you know, that's part of the debate. It should be their decision. The other thing, which was in this expansion, the national government has agreed to pick up 90% of the cost. So one of the justices, I think it was Justice Kagan, said, well, I mean, that sounds like a pretty good deal. How is that coercion? And so that's kind of how the debates were going. Of course, the conservative justices say, well, where's the federal system if the national government can just even bribe you to do to do something that really in a federal system, we're not really sure they have the authority to do that anyway. So that's kind of how the debates came down, at least on that day. Now, of course, the first set of questions of the first hearing date was on the Anti-Injunction Act, which is really the power of the national government to tax, and are you harmed until the penalty is imposed, which would say they don't even need to hear the case right now. I think most people think that that's not going to be considered, and that's not going to be relevant. Then you had the individual mandate, which is really the big, you know, the big mojica of the healthcare law.
Yeah, I mean, that's what everyone's talking about, the individual mandate.
Right, right.
Assuming the court strikes down the individual mandate, are you okay with the remaining parts of the law?
Well, and that goes to the – and I'll answer that question, but that goes to the other part of the debate is severability. Usually in law, when you structure law and you want to protect other portions, you write in that this issue of severability, that the court may find something – illegal, but everything else stands. Well, because of the rush to pass this law, there's no severability language in this bill. I mean, there are some things that a lot of us agree. Having young adults on their parents' policies as long as possible.
26 years of age.
Yeah, yeah. And that's pretty much agreed upon by members on both sides that that's not harmful. The other thing was pre-existing conditions. We like to get people into health insurance plans. So there are things that we all agree are important. Now, whether the Supreme Court keeps them or throws everything out, I think some of the analysis is that even when I was sitting in there, then the courts were saying, well, if we strip the individual mandate, then we are in essence, we are then writing a new statute that doesn't have the base individual mandate, because that does help the insurance companies bring in more revenue to spread the risk. But if you pull out the individual mandate, then what you could see is insurance premiums really skyrocket, because now there's no additional money coming in from a bigger pool. So who knows what's going to happen? I don't think either. Oh, I do. What I do find interesting is that there's 36 people know right now, because supposedly they voted on Friday. The nine justices and their four or three assistants, and I think their voting is done.
Has your opinion about the health care law changed at all from when Congress was first voting on it to now? I mean, has your level of support for it changed?
Well, constitutionally, I mean, I still have the issue. I think everyone believes that everyone should have a health insurance plan or policy. And if you can't afford it, then government ought to help. Now, the question is which level of government. I would prefer, and I've actually, for full disclosure, I endorsed him a couple weeks ago. Mitt Romney, who is much maligned on this health care debate, did it properly. The states can make a decision whether they want to provide an ability for everyone in their state to get access to some health insurance plan or policy. That's what he did. I think there's a real constitutional question of whether the national government – I find it hard to believe that the founding fathers would empower a national government, because if you understand this new constitution that we have, there is a separation of powers because – they didn't trust each other. They didn't trust the legislators. They didn't trust an executive, and they didn't trust the courts. So there's this balance of power. Would they have wanted a national government to be so powerful to be able to tell an individual citizen what good or services they have to buy? I just don't think they would do that.
Assuming the court strikes down at least the individual mandate, do you think parts of the health care law will still exist?
Well, if they just strike the individual mandate, then the remaining provisions are still in law. Now, we'll have to be involved in trying to figure out how we may have to get involved and smooth out the rough edges if you have insurance spikes because of pre-existing condition entry and young adult staying on parents' policies. And I don't know how we would do that. You know, I'd like to see a thriving individual market that is competitive, that has basic catastrophic levels, and then people can buy in at the levels they want based upon the coverage that they want, but at least have the catastrophic coverage. I'd like to see a market much like homeowners insurance or automobile insurance, and that people can buy in at their own levels and maybe get incentivized for healthy living versus having unhealthy living. Maybe your insurance policy should cost more if you're a smoker and a drinker and obese and not exercising. But if you're living a relatively healthy lifestyle, maybe you should be incented in your health insurance package. I think the market will help do that if we allow the market to develop in that way.
You have introduced legislation that would block lawsuits related to E15, which is gasoline blended with 15% ethanol. The auto and gas industries are concerned that they would be held liable if E15 was put in the wrong engine. It could lead to damage, physical harm. Why do you feel this bill is needed?
Well, first of all, we've been very successful in the renewable fuels arena in this country. The U.S. EPA did a rulemaking in which they said E15 is good for a set of vehicles that goes from 2001 model to 2012, no problem. They have not ruled on 2001 earlier. So the question is to the marketers, which are the gas stations in essence, how do they use it or don't they use it? Will they get sued? Will they not get sued? And it's not just them. It's also the refineries themselves. Even though if the EPA says it's good and you do all the issues, one way in which we help decrease our reliance on imported crude oil is the success of ethanol. As we move forward, our ability to use that at retail locations is directly proportional to their ability of whether they're going to get sued or not. And so by having this protection, because remember that the EPA has already said there's no problem, especially with this, with this sector. And so but until these refiners and the marketers feel some more security from lawsuits, and a lot of these marketers are really small family-owned operations that may have 5 to 10 retail locations. They're not like the big Shell stations or BP and Amoco and stuff like that. So they really need the protection.
the idea is that this would bring added fuels into the marketplace.
Well, it also segues into a world in which we have a formula mixture for a liquid transportation fuel regardless of the commodity product. Right now, we're still almost mandated to take gasoline made from crude oil. I would love to see a day where instead of driving up to a gasoline station, we drive up to a refilling station. And that might have natural gas turned into a liquid transportation fuel. That might have methanol. It could have ethanol. It could be even, you know, gasoline from crude oil. But then let the individual consumer pick the fuel type based upon the cost, and let these fuels fight for our dollars at the pump.
So another question, this is related to transportation. The U.S. House brought forth this transportation bill this year that seeks to eliminate funding for the Safe Routes to School program. As a member of the Congressional Bike Caucus, do you believe funding for this program should be cut?
I haven't followed the process. I'm not on the Transportation Committee. As you know, we just did a 90-day extension. The Senate bill, I think, still has that provision in it, which I think most people believe that will be pretty much the base bill for whatever comes out. What the House tried to do unsuccessfully is have a longer bill with a lot of reforms, shifting money around, and also bringing more money to the table through oil and gas exploration recovery and funding. I do understand how Safe Routes to School is probably pretty important to a university community that prides itself on its ability, but it's not that big a deal in 33 counties of Southern Illinois. It's just we're rural, we're a small town, we use buses and we use cars. Some of our schools are way outside of even a if you follow the state of Illinois, there's been a push to regionalism. So when you push to regionalism, you try to locate the schools not in any one town, because then that town wins and the other ones lose. So you got to have to try it, get in between. But that means you're not in an area where people live, and then, so that's really talking about automobiles and buses.
So, I mean, is that something that maybe, at least for now, we could live without funding for Safe Routes?
I think we could. But I also understand that I've been lobbied even by folks in coming to Washington talking about the importance of it. And I believe, really, in metropolitan areas, big urbanized areas, there may be a good argument for that. So that's part of legislation lawmaking is crafting the bill, crafting the language on the highway bill. If it's in the Senate version, it's not in the House version. If you go to conference, those senators have to fight for that piece, and that's part of the jockeying back and forth to finally get a final bill.
Okay. If it does come up in the House, would you, support cutting that funding or keep it?
If we have a House highway, what's happened now is this 90-day bill that we passed, I think, is enough for us to go to conference. So they're trying to negotiate the differences, and the question is, if they do that, what bill comes up in both chambers? And I'll probably be supportive of that bill. I'll be supportive of it if it has it. I'll probably be supportive if it doesn't have it, because then it would have gone through the conference committee, and both sides have kind of cut the deal. I would guess that what comes out of conference will still have Safe Route to Schools, because, again, major metropolitan areas all have U.S. senators, probably feel that that's important, and that's probably something they'll keep in a piece of legislation. And even like a state like Illinois, you've got Senator Kirk and Senator Durbin. I mean, most of Illinoisans live where? Chicago and the Chicago suburbs.
I just know that there are a lot of other pressing issues related to transportation that need to be funded. I guess I was wondering if you feel like that should be a priority now, or if it should just be put down.
It's not the biggest issue we're facing in the highway transportation bill.
You have supported Mitt Romney. Why do you feel like he is the best candidate in the Republican race? Is that because of his polling numbers, his number of delegates?
Yeah.
Because you agree with his issues?
Well, I stayed out of this for a long time because I represent a very conservative part of the state of Illinois, and there's still a lot of conservative questions about him. But also, I was very much involved in supporting Mark Kirk to be our next U.S. senator. And in Illinois, you really do need a centrist, center-right guy, a moderate Republican that doesn't scare off the moderate Republicans or the independents. I think Romney's definitely that guy. So as we were successful with getting behind Mark Kirk and getting Mark Kirk as our junior senator from the state of Illinois, and other than his challenges with his illness, he's been everything we had hoped him to be. I think Mitt Romney is the same thing nationally. He once he gets to the national stage, he was governor of Massachusetts. Come on, as a Republican, I mean, that should tell you that here's a guy who can get elected by independents and Democrats to be governor of Massachusetts. So hopefully he'll appeal well to my more moderate Republican friends in the collar counties and maybe in the university communities of the state, because he's more centrist.
Have you been talking to Senator Kirk on a regular basis?
I did get a chance to visit with him 2 weeks ago, personally. I wrote a column that's on my website just talking about the 45 minutes I spent with him. He is mentally is sharp, talks issues. We talked politics since then. But physically, he's still got some challenges. He has very little use of his left arm, very little use of his left leg. He's spending all his time trying to get as much activity out of, and use out of those as possible, and it's a full-time job for him. Aaron Schock visited him last week, kind of had the same analysis as I did. Aaron got to watch him do some physical therapy, which I didn't, because I went in the evening. Senator Kirk called a lot of candidates after the primaries, which is a very good sign, which helps reemphasize the story that we're telling. Yeah, mentally he's in there. What we need is for thoughts and prayers to continue to go out for Mark, so that he can really get as much use out of his left side as possible, his left arm and his left leg, so he can live an independent lifestyle as much as possible.
Do you know when do you talk at all about when he might be coming back to public life?
No. The only way I try to analyze it is, other than voting, I think he's kind of involved right now. It's a good story. It's a good you've got Republican and Democrat senators carrying his pieces of legislation. You'll even hear Senator Durbin talk about issues. I know that other senators have tried to carry his pieces of legislation. So that's a good story about bipartisanship and camaraderie in the U.S. Senate. I look at Senator Johnson's recovery from a stroke from South Dakota. I look at when did we first start seeing Gabby Giffords come back to the House and House chamber. All of them took about a year. So if this was a January event, based upon how pressing his duties are, it was an election year. So after mid-October, will there be a need for him, and will there be anything going on in Washington until after the election? So I think that's all part of the calculation, and we will see.
Well, this is an election year, and you're running, as we talked about, in a redrawn district that includes parts of Champaign County. How are voters in East Central Illinois, do you feel different than your constituent base in the southern part of the state?
I don't think they are. I mean, you just have to look at the lines. Had I had Champaign-Urbana, that might be a different story. But my, although a lot of people in the university community might commute, most everything south of Paxton, which is in Ford County north of here, you know, circling around Champaign-Urbana. Yeah, I do have Charleston, but it's small town, rural agriculture. Coal mining, marginal oil wells, small town, faith-based communities, very patriotic, very conservative.
How are you trying to court voters in this part of the state?
Well, I'm just trying to be around and available and accessible. You know, right when I'm in a new part of the district, I'm a candidate. When I'm in my congressional district, I'm the sitting congressman. Today I spent, you know, touring a few companies in Danville. I'll do the same thing tomorrow, attending a legislative breakfast tomorrow morning, being available and accessible is kind of how I operate, and that's how I'm doing it.
This is an election year, and you're running in a redrawn district. How are voters in East Central Illinois, do you feel different than your constituent base in the southern part of the state?
I don't think they are. I mean, you just have to look at the lines. Had I had Champaign-Urbana, that might be a different story. But my, although a lot of people in the university community might commute, most everything south of Paxton, which is in Ford County north of here, you know, circling around Champaign-Urbana. Yeah, I do have Charleston, but it's small-town rural agriculture, coal mining, marginal oil wells, small-town faith-based communities, very patriotic, very conservative.
How long do you think you'll be in this job?
I don't know. That's a great question. So, well, I was a term limit guy who didn't keep my term limit pledge after the president asked me to stay in. So I think about it all the time. And one thing I do know is since I'm a subcommittee chairman of the Environment and the Economy Subcommittee, that seniority does have an important role when you're dealing with policies that affect your constituents. And I'm glad I'm there. I'm having it. But it's up to the voters. And so if the voters think I'm doing a poor job, they surely have the opportunity to get rid of me.